We are all evil in some form or another, are we not? People in this day and age are brainwashed and programmed like a computer at being nothing more than puppets. This nation, this country is founded in violence. Violent delights tend to have violent ends. It's madness is something rare in individuals, but in groups, people, and ages, it is a rule. Yes, I am evil. Not 100%, but I am evil.
Now entering The Mortuary, the podcast that offers you an immersive discourse into the occult, paranormal, and conspiracies of the world. We will be your hosts of horror on this journey into the dark. My name is Brock.
And I'm Tanner. It's your boys.
Back at it again podcast. With another serial killer Sunday.
You got it. Listeners who are new to the Mortuary Podcast, this is a super special summer series that we're doing. We did our first one last summer, and it was kind of a hit. We had a really good time with it. So,
and the anal was really good on it, too.
Hope you enjoy it.
Analytics.
Our usual show is a weekly podcast that Brock and I do, and the bi-weekly one is free, so if you are interested in becoming
and the weekly is just $1
a weekly supporter, just like Brock said, for $1 you can have full access to all of our episodes. So
I'd buy that for $1.
Either way, we really appreciate you joining us today. We are going to be talking about the infamous Richard Ramirez, aka the Night Stalker. And come to find out, Richard Ramirez is not the original Night Stalker.
Whoa,
so
really?
I did not know that.
I did not know that either, because the Night Stalker is a pretty famous serial killer.
Yeah, he is. However, he is not really part of the big three or the big four.
Well, yeah, but still.
And so that's why I'm covering him. This summer, Brock and I really wanted to focus more on lesser known serial killers. So that's why Richard Ramirez, he's a pretty big hitter, and I hate to refer to him as that because we're not trying to glorify these people. But he definitely is up there with the more famous ones like BTK or Jeffrey Dahmer.
But the dude could hit some people.
He really did, man. He really did. And it's a pretty tragic story. You are. You're so funny.
Thanks.
And it's heartbreaking at points, but this really happened. This is reality. So we're going to talk about it.
I could be completely off. Was the movie with Jake Gyllenhaal based on him? Or
that was the Zodiac killer.
No.
Yeah, well, he's in you're thinking of Nightcrawler. That's a totally different movie, but
Nightcrawler.
I think Jake Gyllenhaal is in a Zodiac killer movie.
Didn't they base an X-Men character off of Richard Ramirez?
I don't know what you're talking
Nightcrawler
about.
Nightcrawler also. Oh, okay. I was just fucking with you.
Yeah, this is the Night Stalker, my guy.
Actually,
because he stalked people a lot of times at night.
He didn't crawl on people.
He didn't.
Stalked them.
Anyway, without further ado, this is Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. He was an American serial killer, rapist, and burglar. His highly publicized home invasion crime spree terrorized the residents of the greater Los Angeles area and later the residents of the San Francisco area from June 1984 to August 1985.
So really not a long time span or reign as a serial killer.
Right. It was pretty short-lived, but he wasn't the smartest serial killer that we've talked about, and I think a lot of it can be attributed to some childhood trauma and mental problems that we're going to get into.
Okay.
Prior to his capture, Ramirez was dubbed, as we said, the Night Stalker by the news media. He used a wide variety of weapons, including handguns, knives, a machete, a tire iron, and a hammer. Pretty brutal. Ramirez, who was an avowed Satanist, never expressed any remorse for his crimes. The judge who upheld his 13 death sentences remarked that Ramirez's deeds exhibited, quote, cruelty, callousness and viciousness beyond any human understanding.
Wow.
And Ramirez later died of complications from B-cell lymphoma while awaiting execution on California's death row. So that's kind of a brief overview of Richard Ramirez, who he is,
Those are some pretty bold words to come from a judge who literally like tries the worst of the worst.
Yeah, murderers and rapists.
Especially like
and
in L.A.,
molesters.
California, you know.
Yeah, well, in terms of brutality and, like the judge said, just complete callousness, Richard Ramirez is special. He was the kind of person who loved being talked about in the media. He really got off to that. He was a big-time narcissist.
Which isn't uncommon for serial killers.
No, it's not. They really do like the hunt, and they like being hunted.
Yeah.
I don't know what is going on there psychologically, but that seems to be a common strain that we see within the serial killers.
It's the thrill of the fight.
Yeah.
It's the eye of the tiger.
Tiger.
Tangy.
Birdie.
Birdie.
Birdie. Tiger. His mother worked at a boot factory where she was exposed to chemical fumes when she was pregnant with him. And actually, all of his siblings had birth defects ranging from respiratory difficulty to bone deformities.
Do they know why?
Well, the theory right now is that, you know, she worked at this boot factory and was inhaling a lot of fumes. But he was born in they lived in El Paso, Texas.
Right.
And that's where he grew up. And right across the border in New Mexico, there was a lot of nuclear bomb testing going on. And so it is believed that a lot of the fallout from New Mexico would blow downwind into El Paso. I'm not really as sold on that for certain reasons. I think it had a lot more to do with the boot factory and the fumes that she was breathing in. But who's to say? At 2 years old, a dresser fell on Richard's head, causing a large forehead laceration.
Richard!
And at five, he was knocked unconscious from a swing and started experiencing epileptic seizures. So already from the very beginning, he's not doing great.
But that was like his first experience with seizures was after getting knocked in the head.
Right.
Okay.
So you can imagine, I mean, a child at that age, between the age of 2 and, I mean, all the way really until 18, 20 years old, there's a lot of brain development happening. And so it's very possible that after getting hit in the head and having the dresser fall on him, it probably hindered some of that development.
Oh, for sure.
From what I've heard, I think it was actually Melissa who told me this, but somebody was telling me that a lot of serial killers are actually missing a part of their prefrontal lobe in their brain, or it's not fully developed. And it's believed that that is a big reason for their lack of empathy and their lack of...
What?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember who it was that was telling me that. Interesting little tidbit.
I don't know if I believe it.
I don't know.
I don't know.
We're having a lot of fun today.
Thanks for announcing it, fucking weirdo.
His father, a Mexican national and former Juarez policeman who later became a laborer on the Santa Fe Railroad, was prone to fits of anger that often resulted in physical abuse.
Of course it did.
As a 12-year-old, he was strongly influenced by his older cousin Miguel Ramirez, who they called Mike. Now, this is a really important detail of Richard's story.
Hey, Big Mike!
He was a decorated U.S. Army Green Beret combat veteran who often boasted of his gruesome exploits during the Vietnam War. He shared Polaroid photos of his victims, including Vietnamese women he had raped. In some of the photos, his cousin posed with the severed head of a woman he had abused.
I remember this from whenever I've researched Richard Ramirez before.
It's so disturbing.
It's very disturbing.
To know that as a kid, he's at the ripe age of 12 years old, going through puberty, so there's already a lot of hormonal and, again, brain development stuff happening for Richard, and he's trying to understand the world, already has been hindered by his birth defects and his brain trauma as a child. And now he has this cousin that he looks up to. He's a decorated,
absolutely.
He's what's considered to be a war hero. who's influencing him and not saying, not showing Richard that there's anything wrong with what he's showing them.
Well, I mean, he's showing the murders that he's committed.
Exactly. So you can imagine that this probably affected Richard in a very deep way and affected his ability, again, to have empathy towards human beings and not just see them as animals that he can kill.
Also, if you are a 12-year-old boy or girl listening to this podcast, don't look at dead bodies.
Seriously, I grew up with, like, me and Brock both can probably speak to this. Our generation, we grew up with the internet as it was, like, budding and blossoming. And so I remember, I have a lot of memory of going to school with kids who would look at a lot of really gruesome and gory and terrible things on the internet and try to show them
terrible,
to me. And I remember being freaked out about it. So yeah, it's a really gross world if you look too closely.
So don't.
Be careful. Be careful what you look at. Ramirez, who had begun smoking marijuana at the age of 10, bonded with Mike over joints and gory war stories. Mike taught his young cousin some of his military skills, such as killing with stealth and surety. Around this time, Ramirez began to seek escape from his father's violent temper by sleeping in a local cemetery. Again, there's the cemetery thing.
Yeah,
and I also feel like
that could be maybe the one of the seeds that planted, you know, the occultism in him.
Sure. Oh, and we're going to get into some more of that. But what's interesting to note is on one of Richard Ramirez's victims, he actually used a technique on the woman that his cousin Mike had taught him.
Was it the paralyzer?
It wasn't.
Enjoy a paralyzer!
Ramirez, as he was also known as Richie to his family, was present on May 4th, 1973 when his cousin Mike fatally shot his wife Jessie in the face with a .38 caliber revolver during a domestic argument. They were arguing about, like, she was telling him to go get a job and all this kind of stuff. Well, he actually turned around, reached into their refrigerator, which is where he kept his gun. It's weird, but that's where he kept it. Pulled it out and shot her in the head right in front of Mike. That's again,
absolutely insane.
He's a young kid. He's seeing his cousin who he looks up to. He smokes weed with. He hangs out. Yeah. They go on joyrides. He's seeing how he reacted to a woman, how he responded. Absolutely no empathy or anything like that. And so, you can imagine the effect that it had on him.
Oh, yeah.
Mike told Richard to go home, but not say a word to anybody about it. And guess what Richard did? He didn't say a word to anybody about it.
Right.
And then, of course, Mike
snitches
was...
Snitches get stitches.
Yeah, kids. That's something that I learned on the streets.
God.
After the shooting, Richard became sullen and withdrawn from his family and peers. Later that year, he moved in with his older sister, Ruth, and her husband, Roberto. Get this, an obsessive peeping Tom, who took Richard along on his nocturnal exploits. So, yet again, we have another...
Just decided to bond, I guess, by...
Yeah.
Jeez.
Again, we have another adult influence...
Adult
male influence who is, I mean, at that age, your brain is like clay and it's so easily formed. And it's just,
tell us, Dr. Tanner.
It's just crazy. What a recipe for disaster we have here. Now, here's another really interesting detail. Around this time, Richard Ramirez also began using LSD and cultivated an interest in Satanism. Now, I want you to think about something. He's around 12 years old, 12 or 13. What we have here is literally the Holy Trinity or the Unholy Trinity of MKUltra mind control.
100%.
And I'm not saying that Richard Ramirez was mind controlled. That's not what I'm saying. But this is why
it's so effective. But it creates those mind breaks, those disassociative states.
Exactly. It's literally the Unholy Trinity of Satanism, psychedelic drugs, and childhood trauma.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, no wonder it's MKUltra has been so effective because they have figured out what that Trinity is. And there's more to it as well. Mike was found not guilty of Jesse's murder by reason of insanity with his combat record as a mitigating factor. and was released in 1977 after 4 years of incarceration at the Texas State Mental Hospital. His influence over Richard Ramirez continued.
So he just spent 4 years in jail and that was it? They didn't do...
Well, yeah.
Any type of evaluations and or medications?
Hardly jail, too. He was at a mental hospital.
So, but did they say what he was diagnosed with?
I would assume that it's some kind of PTSD because of his exploits in Vietnam. The adolescent Ramirez began to meld his burgeoning sexual fantasies with violence, including forced bondage and rape. While still in school, he took a job at a local Holiday Inn where he used his passkey to rob sleeping patrons. His employment ended abruptly after a hotel guest returned to his room to find Ramirez attempting to rape his wife.
Jesus.
Now, this is crazy. Though the husband beat Ramirez senseless at the scene, criminal charges were dropped when the couple, who lived out of state, declined to return to testify against him. They did not want to come back to Texas and relive what had happened.
Well, yeah.
So they just were like, we're dropping it. We're staying out.
They shouldn't have dropped it, but I understand.
I agree.
I understand their feelings.
Ramirez.
Or let me rephrase that. I can empathize with their feelings.
Sure. Well, and it's really a shame that they didn't do anything because, man, he would have probably been in jail.
At least for a little while.
At least somebody. I mean, who knows? He could have ended up having an experience in prison where he decided, I don't want to live a life of violence and crime. You know, I mean, it's just, I don't know. Who knows? But he dropped out of high school in the ninth grade. At the age of 22, he moved to California, where he settled permanently. And this California, like I said, is where crimes really took place.
You say he dropped out of the ninth grade at age 22?
No, this is just detailing a little timeline of his.
Okay, so he dropped out of the ninth grade, and then at the age of 22,
right,
he moved to California.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I'm with you.
So now we're going to get into the actual murders.
We've made some new friends over at huntakiller.com, and we'd like to introduce you to them. We know that if you're a listener of The Mortuary, then you are already in love with the macabre and are most likely a true crime aficionado of sorts. That's why you need to know about this one-of-a-kind subscription box and the community around it.
In this golden age of television and podcasts, we all know the value of a truly compelling narrative. So what if we told you about a brand new way to experience a story?
Hunt a Killer is a murder mystery subscription box where a detective enlists your help in solving a murder. This detective sends you a box with letters, documents, clues, and evidence every month. With each box, you'll be able to eliminate a suspect and get one step closer to cracking the case. You are part of this fictional world, and we're relying on your detective skills to piece together this story and catch the killer.
Hunt a Killer has really upped the subscription box game too. High quality, handcrafted clues get you lost in the fictional world and make you feel like you're solving a real murder. Handcrafted police records, town maps, photographs, and much more allows you to become completely immersed in the experience.
As if all of this wasn't enough reason for you to join the hunt, with every episode of Hunt a Killer that's delivered, they will help fund the cold case efforts at the Cold Case Foundation, which is dedicated to stopping the deadly compounding effect of cold cases and providing hope and resources to families affected by violent crime.
This is the perfect date night or game night for you and your fellow true crime lovers. You don't want to miss this exclusive opportunity.
Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com and use the coupon code MORTUARY at checkout to get 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 new members a day, so stop whatever you are doing and head over to huntakiller.com right now to get 20% off your first box when you use the code MORTUARY at checkout.
All right, Brock, buckle up. Listeners, do the same because about to get brutal. Listener discretion is advised. This is extremely graphic.
Let's get nasty.
On April 10th, 1984, Ramirez murdered a 9-year-old girl named Mei Lung in a hotel basement. She was of Asian descent, I'm assuming.
I wasn't ready.
Where he was living in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco. He raped and beat the girl before stabbing her to death and hanged her body from a pipe. This, his first known killing, was not initially identified as being connected to the crime spree. In 2009, his DNA was matched to a sample obtained at the crime scene, because back then they didn't have the technology right. to test the DNA. In 2016, officials disclosed evidence of a second suspect identified through a DNA sample retrieved from the crime scene, who is believed to have been present at Lung's murder. Authorities have not publicly identified the suspect, described as being a juvenile at the time, and have not brought charges due to the lack of evidence. So apparently somebody else was there
while he committed this first atrocity.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
That's awful.
This girl, she was Asian, and it makes me wonder, you know, the very first dead bodies, the dead women that he ever saw, you know, were Vietnamese women.
That's so a good connection.
I wonder if there was something there that triggered him.
That's very interesting.
On June 28th, 1984, 79-year-old, and this is really sad, 79-year-old Ginny Vincow was found brutally murdered in her apartment in Glasgow Park.
So he just did a huge age jump.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Very young to on the older side, definitely. She had been stabbed repeatedly while asleep in her bed, and her throat slashed so deeply that she was nearly decapitated. Richard Ramirez's fingerprint was found on a mesh screen he removed to gain access through an open window. And this is the woman that it's thought that she... This is the woman that it is believed that he used the technique that his cousin Mike taught him to use.
Okay. What was that technique?
Just the decapitation, however he learned how to do it. On March 17, 1985, Ramirez attacked 22-year-old Maria Hernandez outside her home in Rosemead, shooting her in the face with a .22 caliber handgun after she pulled into her garage. She survived when the bullet ricocheted off the key she held in her hand as she lifted them to protect herself. So talk about good luck.
Wow.
Inside the house was her roommate, Daily Okazaki, 34 years old, who heard the gunshot and ducked behind a counter when she saw Ramirez enter the kitchen. When she raised her head, he shot her once in the forehead, killing her.
Jeez.
Within an hour of the Rosemead home invasion, Ramirez pulled a 30-year-old Cy Leon Veronica Yu out of her car in Monterey Park, another Asian woman, shot her twice with a .22 caliber handgun and fled.
He's just on a rampage.
She was pronounced dead upon arrival at the hospital. The two murders and the third attempt in a single day attracted extensive coverage from the news media, who dubbed the curly-haired attacker with bulging eyes and wide-spaced rotting teeth the walk-in killer and the valley intruder. And an interesting little side note, he had a really bad diet and did not care about personal hygiene, and a lot of his victims who survived described him as having the worst breath they had ever smelled.
Ooh.
Ooh. March 27th, 1985, he entered a home that he had burglarized a year earlier at approximately 2 a.m. and killed the sleeping Vincent Zazara, age 64, with a gunshot to his head from a .22 caliber handgun.
Now, this was a male.
Right. But his wife, Maxine, age 44, was awakened by her husband's murder, so Ramirez beat her and bound her hands while demanding to know where her valuables were. He ransacked the room, tried to steal stuff, but she escaped her bonds and grabbed a shotgun from under the bed, but turns out it wasn't loaded. This infuriated Ramirez, so he shot her three times with the .22 and then got a carving knife from the kitchen. This is pretty brutal, pretty graphic, so strap in. He mutilated her body by stabbing her several times and gouged out her eyes and placed them in a jewelry box, which he left with. Vincent and Maxine's bodies were discovered by their son, Peter. So that is really heartbreaking, really tragic. May 14th, 1985, he returned to Monterey Park and entered the home of Bill Doy, 66, and his disabled wife, Lillian, 56. Surprising Doy in his bedroom, Ramirez shot him in the face with a .22. pistol, and as Bill Doy went for his own handgun. After beating the mortally wounded man into unconsciousness, Ramirez entered Lillian's bedroom, bound her with thumb cuffs, and then raped her after he had ransacked the home for valuables. And keep in mind, she was disabled. So again, that is so heartbreaking to hear, so tragic. But he didn't care. He did not care how old they were, how young they were. He was just on a rampage, like you said. On the night of May 29th, 1985, he drove a stolen Mercedes-Benz and stopped at the house of Mabel Bell, 83, and her sister Florence Lang, 81. He found a hammer in the kitchen and bludgeoned and bound the invalid Lang in her bedroom, and then bound and bludgeoned Bell before using electrical cord to shock the woman. After raping Lang, remember these ladies are in their 80s,
yeah.
He used Mabel Bell's lipstick to draw a pentagram on her thigh, as well as on the walls of both bedrooms. Discovered 2 days later, both women were found alive but comatose. Bell later died of her injuries. So tragic, so sad. The next day, he drove the same car to Burbank and snuck into the home of Carol Kyle, 42. At gunpoint, he bound Kyle and her 11-year-old son with handcuffs and ransacked the house. He released Kyle to direct him to the family, to where the family's valuables were. He then sodomized her repeatedly. He also repeatedly ordered her to not look at him, telling her at one point that he would, quote, cut her eyes out. He fled the scene after retrieving the child from the closet and binding the two together again with the handcuffs. So for whatever reason, he let them live. Very interesting. I think that's probably why he ordered them not to look at him, because he knew he wasn't going to let them live for whatever reason. And he didn't want them to have a description. Wouldn't you say?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. Maybe because it was just a boy and his mother. Maybe that resonated with
him. Maybe so. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's really interesting. Because obviously he doesn't have a problem killing and raping children.
Right. Listeners, I hope you're doing all right, but stick with us because we still got a little bit more to go. On July 5th, 1985... Ramirez broke into a home in Sierra Madre and bludgeoned 16-year-old Whitney Bennett with a tire iron as she slept in her bedroom. After searching in vain for a knife in the kitchen, Ramirez attempted to strangle the girl with a telephone cord. Hold on.
Who can't find a knife in a kitchen?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. He must have checked every drawer but the right one. That sounds like something I would do.
Are you a serial killer?
Maybe I am. He was startled to see sparks emanate from the cord, and when his victim began to breathe, he fled the house believing that Jesus Christ had intervened and saved her.
What?
Now get this, here's the deal. He was an avowed Satanist, right?
Right.
But there's two kinds of Satanism. There's LaVeyan Satanism, which he was very obsessed with Anton LaVey.
Right.
But there's also Satanism that actually believes in the entity of Satan and worships him as God. But within that Satanism, Jesus, God, heaven, they're real.
Right.
But he just chooses to follow Satan.
Right.
Okay, so when he saw Jesus Christ, he believed that this was kind of an attack on him.
Right.
And so if you believe in Satan, then you also have to believe in the power of God, right? So he fled the scene. On July 7th, 1985, Ramirez burglarized the home of Joyce Lucille Nelson, who was 61 years old. Finding her asleep on her living room couch, he beat her to death using his fist and kicking her in the head. A shoe print from an Avia sneaker was left imprinted on her face. That's how badly he stomped her. After cruising two other neighborhoods, he returned to Monterey Park and chose the home of Sophie Dickman, 63 years old.
Do we know, like, his choosing process, or how he picked homes or picked victims?
From what we know, it was completely random.
Like, he just saw a house and was like, all right, this one.
He believed in the Crowleyan commandment, do as thou wilt, will be the whole of the law. He handcuffed Dickman at gunpoint, attempted to rape her, and stole her jewelry. When she swore to him that he had taken everything of value, he told her to, quote, swear to Satan. On July 20th, he purchased a machete before driving a stolen Toyota to Glendale. He chose the home of Layla Needing, who was 66, and her husband Maxon, who was 68. He burst into the couple's room, who were asleep, hacked them with a machete, killed them with shots to the head from a .22 caliber handgun, and then he mutilated their bodies with a machete before robbing the house of valuables. I swear, this has to be the most brutal and sadistic murderer that we've covered.
Yeah.
After quickly fencing the stolen items from the Needing residence, he drove to Sun Valley. At around 4:15 a.m. in the morning, he broke into the home of the Kavanaugh family. He murdered Shinarong Kavanaugh by shooting the sleeping man in the head with a .25 caliber handgun, killing him instantly. He then repeatedly raped his wife, Somkid, beating her and sodomizing her. He bound the couple's terrified 8-year-old son before dragging Somkin around the house to reveal the location of any valuable items, which he stole. During his assault, he demanded that she, quote, again, swear to Satan that she was not hiding any money from him. So he was stealing cars, going from town to town, house to house,
right,
making the owner, the people in the house, show him where the valuables at. He would sell those, and he would use that money to get from place to place. On August 6th, he drove to Northridge and broke into the home of Chris and Virginia Peterson. He crept into the bedroom, and which startled Virginia, prompting him to shoot her in the face with a 25 caliber semi-automatic handgun, which I've never heard of a 25 caliber round, but it's mentioned that a couple times. Chris Peterson fought back while avoiding being hit by two more shots during the struggle before Richard Ramirez managed to escape. The couple survived their injuries.
Wow.
On August 8th, he drove a stolen car to Diamond Bar and went into the home of Sakina Abawith, who was 27, and her husband, Elias. Sometime after 2:30, he entered the house and went into the master bedroom. He instantly killed the sleeping Elias with a shot to the head from his gun. He handcuffed and beat Sakina while forcing her to reveal the location of the family's jewelry, and then, of course, brutally raped her.
Yeah.
He repeatedly demanded that she, quote, again, swear to Satan that she would not scream during his assaults. When the couple's 3-year-old son entered the bedroom, Ramirez tied the child up and then continued to rape her. After Ramirez left the home, Sakina untied her son and sent him to the neighbors for help. Ramirez, who had been following the media coverage of his crimes,
which was pretty typical.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was like a big-time narcissist, and so he was all about the media covering him, right, and him being on the news, all that kind of stuff. He left the Los Angeles area and headed to the San Francisco Bay Area. On August 18th, Ramirez entered the home of Peter and Barbara Pan. That's kind of funny because the husband's name was Peter Pan. But what's not funny is that he shot Peter, who was 66 years old, in the temple in his sleep with his handgun. He then beat and sexually abused Barbara, his wife, who was 62 years old, before he shot her in the head and left her for dead. At the crime scene, Ramirez used lipstick to scrawl a pentagram and the phrase, Jack the Knife, on the bedroom wall.
Jack the Knife.
Yeah, I don't really know what that's supposed to mean, but Ramirez is famous for a picture of him with his hand up in a courtroom.
Right, and it's got the
pentagram drawn, either drawn or etched onto his hand. I don't know how it got there. When it was discovered that the ballistics and shoe print evidence from the Night Stalker crime scenes matched the Pan crime scene, then-mayor of San Francisco Dianne Feinstein divulged the information in a televised press conference. This leak infuriated the detectives in the case, as they knew the killer would be following media coverage, giving him opportunity to destroy crucial forensic evidence.
So why, do we know why she did that? Like, just to try to warn people or to, like, make some sort of political move?
It's hard to say, man. I think probably as a mayor, I would feel a responsibility to protect the citizens of my city, of my town. And I don't know. It's hard to say what she was thinking, but yeah, it definitely made things difficult.
She justified it some way.
Yeah. Ramirez, who indeed had been watching the press, dropped his size 11.5 Avia sneakers over the side of the Golden Gate Bridge that night. He remained in the area for a few days before heading back to the Los Angeles area.
Did he get new shoes, or was he just barefoot at this point?
I don't know, but this guy was such a mess, he was such a wreck, that I wouldn't be surprised if he just went barefoot. On August 24th, Ramirez traveled 76 miles south of Los Angeles in a stolen orange Toyota to Mission Viejo. That night, he arrived at the home of James Romero Jr., who had just returned from a family vacation to Rosarito Beach in Mexico. Romero's son, 13-year-old James Romero III, happened to be awake and heard Ramirez's footsteps outside the house. Thinking that there was a prowler, James went to wake his parents and Ramirez fled the scene.
Oh.
James raced outside and was able to note the color, make, and style of the car, as well as a partial license plate number.
So Richard got spooked.
He got spooked, and now we have information on the color and the make and the model, right, of his car, and then we also have some forensic evidence, including a shoe print and the woman's face, so which is horrible.
Was
but
he, like, trying to break in and then, like, overheard, like, them communicating or something, or he just somehow got spooked and fled?
That's a good point, because it says that James went to wake his parents, so he must have been in the house, and whenever he maybe
like in the process of getting in the house,
right, and maybe he saw lights turn on, there was commotion happening. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Okay. Romero contacted the police with this information, believing James had chased away a thief. So there must have been a little bit more to that story.
Well, it sounds like they didn't know that it was the Night Stalker. They just thought somebody was trying to break into their home.
Absolutely. After this encounter, Ramirez broke into the house of Bill Carnes, who was 30 years old, and his fiance, Inez Erickson, who was 29, through a back door. Ramirez entered the bedroom of the sleeping couple and awakened Carnes when he cocked his handgun. He shot Carnes 3 times in the head before turning his attention to Erickson. Ramirez told the terrified woman that he was, quote, the Night Stalker, and forced her to swear she loved Satan as he beat her with his fist and bound her with neckties from the closet.
I was going to make a voice, but after you said beat her with his fist,
it took a really dark turn, yeah. After stealing what he could find, he dragged Erickson to another room to rape and sodomize her. He then demanded cash and more jewelry, typical Richard Ramirez style. Yeah. Making Erickson, quote, swear on Satan, there was no more.
Once again.
Before leaving the home, Ramirez told Erickson, quote, tell them the Night Stalker was here. Erickson untied herself and went to a neighbor's house to get help for her severely injured fiance. Surgeons were able to remove 2 of the bullets from his head, and thank God he survived his injuries.
Holy shit.
That's incredible. And if this is who I'm thinking of, there is a pretty famous interview with one of Richard Ramirez's victims, which is where he talks about the guy who was shot in the head. I think he ended up being paralyzed from the waist down.
Oh, no.
And he just talks about how, like, he lost his memory and everything about his life. And, you know, the Night Stalker took that from him. It's pretty heartbreaking. Erickson was able to give a detailed description of the assailant to investigators, and police were able to obtain a cast of Ramirez's footprint from the Romero house. The stolen car was found on August 28th in Wilshire Center of Los Angeles, and police were able to obtain a single fingerprint from the rearview mirror despite Ramirez's careful efforts to wipe the car clean of his prints.
So what, he missed the fucking smudgy rearview mirror while he was wiping everything down?
Yeah, well, I mean, he wasn't in the greatest state of mind at this time. I mean, his nutrition was horrible, and he was, you know, just frenzied.
He's a rat-looking motherfucker, too.
He really was. The print was positively identified as belonging to Ramirez, who was described as a 25-year-old drifter from Texas with a long rap sheet that included many arrests for traffic and illegal drug violations. Law enforcement officials decided to release to the media a mugshot of Ramirez from December 12, 1984, which was a year earlier. From an arrest for car theft, and at this point, the Night Stalker finally had a face. At the police press conference, it was announced, "We know who you are now, and soon everyone else will. There will be no place you can hide."
So, did they announce his name at the press conference, or they just showed his face?
They released the mugshot of him because they were certain that they knew who he was. They were certain that they had the right guy.
Okay, but they just didn't say his name. I don't understand, like, the threat behind "we know who you are and soon everyone will too" if you've already told everybody who he is.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think it's just the fact that, you know, his face is now being, the picture of his face is being spread around.
I
get it.
I think the cops could have said something a little more, you know, threatening.
Right.
Or intimidating. Because it's, you know, the fucking Night Stalker, but whatever.
Yeah, they could have said, like, "We're gonna chop your leg off.
We're coming to get you, Nighty."
On August 30th, 1985, Ramirez took a bus to Tucson, Arizona to visit his brother. Unaware that he had become the lead story in virtually every major newspaper and television news program.
So the one time he doesn't check the fucking media?
Right. Well, you know, he didn't have access to the internet the way we do now. He didn't have a phone in his pocket where he could just pull it up. So it would have been more difficult if he was on the run, especially out in Arizona, out in the middle of nowhere.
I'm just saying that he made it such a big point to, like, always stroke his ego on the media and then, like, The one time it really matters, he...
Well, he might have been really running scared at this point. He might have been abandoning his ego. After failing to meet his brother, he returned to Los Angeles early on the morning of August 31st. He walked past officers who were staking out the bus terminal in hopes of catching the killer should he attempt to flee on an outbound bus.
But they didn't catch him?
Well, get this. After noticing a group of elderly Mexican women fearfully identifying him as El Matador, or, quote, the killer, Ramirez saw his face on the covers on the newspaper rack and fled the store in a panic. After running across the Santa Ana Freeway, he attempted to carjack a woman but was chased away by the bystanders who pursued him. After hopping over several fences and attempting two more carjackings, he was eventually subdued by a group of residents, one of whom had struck him over the head with a metal bar in the pursuit. The group held Ramirez down, relentlessly beating him until police arrived and took him into custody.
Fuck yeah.
And apparently they really, really beat the crap out of him.
Is it because they recognized him?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
They knew who he was, and he had just...
Excellent.
You know, he had been trying to carjack people in their community. And I think it's interesting that it was like at the beginning of his run, he had this energy and this power. Right. But it's almost like it's depleting now. It's running
like,
out.
Now that he's been exposed.
And he's just like a pathetic little rat that they're all just, you know, nothing is going his way anymore.
Well, I mean, I've said this off the show before, and I feel like this is a perfect example of it too, that strong communities make police involvement like unnecessary. You know what I mean? Like, it's, we don't really tend to get too political here on the Mortuary, but I just think that this is a great example of that.
Yeah, I agree, man. The community comes together. We can really, you know, police
beat the shit out of a serial killer.
Well, we can police ourselves. But that's a conversation for another day. I'm going to wrap it up right here. That was the end of his run.
Right.
And, you know, he went to prison. He had a lot of really...
Because he was running at that moment.
Yeah. He had a lot of interesting court appearances, a lot of really weird and chilling interviews that you can find, listeners, on YouTube. And I highly recommend you do, because they're extremely insightful. There's a lot to unpack. He talks about Satanism, and he talks about how he believes that he is evil, yes, but he also believes that everyone is evil. And he really talks scripted. That's really the best way to describe it. It's very scripted, like he's reading off paper whenever he's being interviewed. So like I said, there's a lot to unpack in those interviews. And he ultimately died of complications from B-cell lymphoma while awaiting his execution. So he never actually was executed on death row.
Those B-cells, man, they'll get you.
Yep. So that is the story of Richard Ramirez.
In a nutshell, obviously not an in-depth, comprehensive, but this is Serial Killer Sunday, where we just like...
We like to keep it short and sweet, and this one went a lot longer than our typical ones do. But there was just so much to Richard Ramirez, and I felt like I was speeding through all of his crimes because there was just so much there. And I think he will be one of the most, if not the most, brutal and sadistic and calloused serial killers that we cover.
We'll let our listeners be the judge of that.
Yeah, you guys can decide. But I hope you guys enjoy that episode. Brock, I hope you did too.
Hell yeah.
It's sad. It's heartbreaking that somebody like this could exist.
Hell yeah.
But, you know, he is a result of a violent culture.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, thanks again for joining us. We hope that you guys will continue
supporting
us. Enjoy your Sunday, yeah.
Unless you're not listening to this on Sunday, then we hope you have a great day. Thanks for tuning in to
whatever day it is.
Serial Killer Sunday. We'll see you next time as we enter into the Mortuary.
Goodbye.